afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host on this first day of meteorological spring. Ever since I found out that meteorologists mark the seasons by the first day of the month of the solstice, I've celebrated spring on the 1st of March. We get 3 extra weeks. I'm happier. And today, given our subject matter, it helps if I'm happier. We have a very large audience today. The subject is intense, and I think everybody's looking for answers. And I know that many of you are here because our speaker is Elon Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council. You've heard him here before, and you know that this is where we get a lot of our insights. Before we go to Elon, I'm going to give you the JPC commercial, shortened today because we have a lot to cover. The Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985. As a 501c3 organization, providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy by leading scholars, authors, You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, and free speech and intellectual diversity. And we advocate for Ukraine today. Our guest is Elon Berman, Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, an expert on regional security in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Russian Federation. He has consulted for the CIA, for the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and he has provided information on national security and policy to a number of congressional offices and government agencies. Elon is a member of the Associated Faculty at Missouri State University's Department of Defense and Strategic Studies. A frequent writer and commentator, he has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, the New York Times, Foreign Policy, the Washington Post, and in our own In Focus Quarterly magazine, which makes us very happy. So I'm really happy today as we get started on a grim subject. He is the author of several books, including Iran's Deadly Ambition, The Islamic Republic's Quest for Global Power, and Tehran Rising, Iran's Challenge to the United States. His most recent book is The Fight for Iran, Opposition Politics, Protest, and the Struggle for the Soul of a Nation. We'll get him back to do these things. My personal favorite book of his is Implosion, The End of Russia and What It Means for America. And I think those themes are going to show up here today. Elon, I'm going to start by asking you to begin with Putin's war aims and how much of what we're seeing out there now is the striking out that happens sometimes when a country sees its own demise coming. Hitler did that in the Battle of the Bulge. He didn't think he was saving the Reich, but he was going to make the Allies pay for every mile to Berlin. So is Putin trying to salvage the empire, or does he really think he's going to expand it? You're on.
Thanks, Shoshana. And by the way, thank you for hosting this. And all of my answers are subject to revision by historical events. When you and I talked about this, doing this last week, I sent you a few bullet points, and I can't help but noticing that most of them either are obsolete or need to be updated in terms of what we're going to talk about. But this one doesn't. The idea of sort of what animates Putin, what drives him, and you know. You're seeing a lot of commentary these days that harken back to 2005. So 2005, right around this time of the year, Putin goes to the Munich, famous Munich Security Conference in Munich, Germany, and he talks about how the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, right? And that becomes the frame and has become the frame through which everybody has sort of looked at Putin, right? Everything that he is doing, people tend to, in a very simplistic term, tend to ascribe to, oh, he's trying to recreate the USSR. He's, by the way, he's from the KGB. This is very close to home. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. He's essentially a Soviet. And I don't think that's actually correct. And for those of you that are interested in sort of delving a little bit deeper, there's two pieces of literature that I would recommend. The first is his February 21st speech, in which he laid out, before the invasion, he laid out the sort of the intellectual conceptual case for why military action against Ukraine is necessary. And the second is that elaboration that happened on February 24th. So the Russians began their invasion in the early morning hours of February 24th by our clock. And later that day, Russia time, he went on television and he talked about, he sort of laid out the conceptual case for why this was necessary, why this was inevitable, and why this was a just war. And a lot of what he talked about sort of glided over the question of the Soviet Union, in fact, in fairly unfavorable terms, because what he talked about was the fact that Lenin and Stalin made a mistake in allowing the republics too much autonomy, too much national identity, and didn't sort of leaving them to be more independent than they should be otherwise. And that the sort of the federalism that you saw in the Soviet Union was actually the precursor, sort of laid the foundation for all this stuff. And it was very clear that he sort of, he assigned that blame directly to the feet of Soviet leaders. And what he's actually talking about is not so much a recreation of the Soviet Union, but a recreation of the Russian Empire. A Russian Empire where different ethnicities were tethered very closely to the federal center, didn't have autonomy, didn't have a national identity of their own, sort of took their cues from what Moscow, sort of you know, monarchical Moscow was saying, and didn't speak up on their own. That's a useful, I think, scene setter, because it really helps describe and helps explain how Putin sees Ukraine. So if you go back 1,000 years, 1,200 years ago, Kievan Rus, the area that that encompassed what is now modern day Ukraine, modern day Belarus and parts of Russia, was the single largest state, nation state entity in Europe at the time. And it was the seat from which the Russian Empire sprang. So in the Russian imperial conception, there is no revived Russian Empire if you don't have Ukraine, which is why Putin and his ilk talk so much about how Ukrainian identity is fabricated, we're all one people, and we're going in there to liberate them, right? Because it fits very nicely into that imperial narrative. Beyond that, beyond the imperial narrative, what Putin's trying to do is put into practice this idea that the best defense is a good offense. As seen from Moscow, you are looking at a steady creep of an expanding Western alliance and expanding Western values into what Russia sort of legitimately or illegitimately calls its periphery, calls its geopolitical backyard. And so when you look at the Putin speeches from February 21st, from February 24th, he talks a lot about how action in Ukraine is necessary now to deter NATO from moving later. Now, the irony, of course, here is twofold. First of all, by invading Ukraine, Putin has actually brought Russia closer to NATO himself voluntarily, right? Which is something that Russian propagandists don't really talk about. And the second is that it's backfired gloriously, and it's created this sort of unity and cohesion on the part of Europe that, frankly, we haven't seen in over a generation since the collapse of the Soviet Union. We're seeing a sort of reinvigorated support of NATO as an idea. The European Union just about a half hour ago voted to accept Ukraine as a candidate nation. Doesn't mean that Ukraine is going to be part of the EU necessarily, but you know, sort of the wheels are being greased for that to happen and to be fast-tracked. So what Putin is thinking and what's actually happening are, I think, two very separate things. But I hope that at least gives you a sense of sort of where he was coming from. And you know, given the past track record of Western disunity, of, you know, a NATO in decline, of an America that's eating itself politically, that miscalculation maybe is more understandable, right? When he's sort of looking out from Moscow and looking at a disunited West and saying all these ideas, Russian greatness, revival of the empire, denigration of Ukraine, might be an easy sell. Turns out that it's not, but I think he can be forgiven for at least temporarily thinking that it might be. So.
Mute myself.
Okay.
You mentioned demographics. Tell us a little bit about how that works. I mean, sure. The book was all about demographics, and what Russians worry about, or at least what Putin does. But I think we need to go over this here. I think this is not well understood.
No, I think that's exactly right. And the demographic component looms very large. And this is where you see that disconnect between Russian imperialism and Soviet nostalgia, right? Because the Soviet Union, if you're a Soviet nostalgist, you sort of want to recreate the totality of the USSR. That's actually not what Putin and his supporters are doing. They're preferring Slavic areas of the former Soviet Union, right? What they're talking about is a revival of Greater Russia, of the idea of a greater Slavic state. And by the way, that's an idea that has a tremendous amount of purchase across the Russian political spectrum, from liberals to conservative. The great writer and philosopher Alexander Solzhenitsyn, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, actually gave a speech advocating for Greater Russia on the floor of the Duma, the Russian lower house of parliament, right? Just to standing ovations. This is a great sort of popular rallying cry, but it naturally sort of elevates certain parts of the former Soviet Union and denigrates others. Russia is not so interested in the Central Asian states, despite what Central Asian officials might say, because they're Muslim, majority Muslim countries, and there's not a lot of Slavs there. But places like Kazakhstan, for example, places like Belarus, places like Ukraine, places like Estonia are very much front and center in the national conception of Russian imperialists, because that's the place where the Slavs are. And this becomes enormously important when you look at Russia's demographic trajectory. Russia has been declining demographically, right? So for demographers, the magic number is 2.1. Every woman should have 2.1 children on average during her fertile lifespan. One to replace herself, one to replace her husband, and 0.1 for accidents and earthquakes and whatever. The Russian fertility rate is far lower than that. It is Ukraine's, by the way, is even lower than that. But that's a different conversation. But Russia is in this demographic downward spiral. And it's a sort of, it feeds into everything that Vladimir Putin thinks about, because Russian demographic decline has far-reaching strategic implications, right? The emptying of the Russian Far East and competition with China, for example. The sort of the migration of Russians from the Far East to European Russia, the out-migration of Russians who used to live in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg into Europe. All of that weighs very heavily on Russian decision makers. And so when Putin is covetous of what are now foreign sovereign countries, he's covetous of some more than others. And the ones that he's covetous of are the places where the Russians are. And that's why there's so much talk about a greater Russia. There's so much talk about, in the context of Ukraine, about Novorossiya, new Russia, the recreation of this sort of sphere of influence. It has everything to do with demographics as well as imperialism.
So just as a counterpoint, I think it's interesting to note that Israel has the highest per capita birth rate in the Western world, and it is over 3 children per Israeli Jewish woman, which is interesting because the Arab birth rate has gone down somewhat, and they're kind of matching each other, 3 Arab children to Arab Israelis and 3 Jewish Israeli children to Jewish Israelis. So Ukraine and Russia and most of the rest of Europe could see themselves fighting for population as well as other resources. So let's talk about other resources. There is an economic dimension to this that's not only sanctions. I'm going to ask you about sanctions. Right. But there's an economic dimension to this as well. Help us.
All right. Okay. So the phrase that everybody needs to know is Fortress Russia, right? This is what has come to be known as Russia's dominant economic strategy. By the way, it's not necessarily an anti-Western strategy, but it's one that's really been turbocharged as a result of COVID. Your lights are flashing. As a result of COVID, where the Russian government took a look at what was happening to the national economy, the economic dislocation that accompanied the advent of the pandemic, and they decided we are preferring stability over growth. We're going to have fiscal austerity. We're going to husband all sorts of resources. We're not going to invest in different projects like other countries did. We are going to essentially stabilize the base. And they've been enormously successful in doing that. the sort of the back of the envelope calculation is that Russia now has about $630 billion of foreign exchange reserves, but not of readily available foreign exchange reserves. And this is where the sanctions come in, because Russia has focused on husbanding all these resources and also on diversifying what denomination they're in, right? They're not in rubles, right? By the way, as you've seen, the ruble is sort of in this this death spiral currently. And I'll talk about that in a second. But a lot of Russia's exchange reserves are in denominated in euros. They're denominated in Chinese yuan. And there's a reason for that, because they're trying to decouple from the US dollar as much as possible. The US dollar is still sort of very strong in Russia. In fact, when you're seeing Muscovites, you know, make runs on banks now, and they're pulling out predominantly dollars because the dollar is still a very strong currency. But the Russian government has tried to get ahead of this curve and tried to sort of diversify what denominations their exchange reserves are in. But they haven't been able to fully diversify where the currency is held. So an interesting little sort of side note that's really germane to where the sanctions are and why you're seeing a lot of economic dislocation in Russia is that half of that $630 billion in Russia's reserves is actually offshore. It's not in Russia itself. So the measures that the European Union and the United States took over the weekend to cut off access, international access for Russian banks, not for all Russian banks, but for a lot of Russian banks, has electrocuted Russia's ability to access those offshored foreign reserves. So Russia is actually a lot poorer, right, than Russian officials were expecting. And that's why you're seeing moves like what the Kremlin did today, which is it started banning capital flight. It started preventing the accounts of foreign companies from actually transferring money out of the country, right? Because they're worried, they're hemorrhaging. And this is where I think that sort of the sanctions conversation becomes really germane. There's half a dozen, 10 things that are really impactful and can be impactful on the Russian economy, right? Everything from personal sanctions against Vladimir Putin and his cronies to de-swifting to all sorts of other measures. And you're increasingly, with, I would argue, astonishing rapidity, watching the West begin to tick off those measures, begin to sort of go down the list and say, we're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this. The one thing that isn't really sort of at issue now, and you sort of see discussion of it on Fox News, for example, on conservative channels, because it's intimately linked with American energy independence and American energy security. It's the question of how dependent we are actually on Russia for oil. Because what you've seen over the last year, year and a quarter, has been this Biden administration walk away from the idea of American energy independence, right? A sort of a downplaying of American independent sources of energy and growing reliance on foreign suppliers for oil. And I would argue not the proper foreign suppliers that don't happen to be our friends, like Russia. So right now, we import on average 500,000 barrels daily of Russian oil. Now, think for a second of the global price of a barrel of oil. It's upwards of $100. But for the sake of, you know, so I'm terrible at math. So right, for the sake of math, let's say it's $100. We, American taxpayers, the U.S. government, are subsidizing the Russian war effort to the tune of $50 million. Right? If I'm doing my math
right. I don't know. I don't do math any better than you do. But let's just agree that it's a lot of money.
I think it's $50 million. Okay. So let's presume that my math is more than remedial. $50 million a day, right? Whatever it is, it's a substantial amount. And it is it helps to inform why the Biden administration now is not leading the pack, but trailing the pack in terms of the measures that it can implement, right? Yesterday, we saw Canada unilaterally divest itself of oil imports from Russia. We are in a far less advantageous position with regard to that because of how heavy our dependence is to Russia. And that's why you're seeing the White House, and tonight is the State of the Union. We're going to hear lots about transatlantic unity, lots about the U.S. leading from the front. But on this issue, at least, the U.S. isn't leading from the front. And it's not leading from the front because it happens to be disproportionately dependent on Russian energy.
Well, Germany also, I mean, even more than we. Is that right. The reason that not all the banks have been sanctioned? You need someplace to pay for your oil if you're going to keep importing it? I mean, I had initially wondered why we didn't just apply SWIFT sanctions everywhere, but I suspect that it has to do with the ability to pay for the oil. The Russians have to be able to get the money.
I believe that's right. And President Biden, in his speech last week, when he talked about the measures that we would be implementing, which obviously those measures have been strengthened tremendously by what Europe has done, actually took pains to create some daylight between himself and Europe, saying, you know, the Europeans aren't quite there on de-swifting, right? Sort of implying that the U.S. is, but we're waiting on Europe. But now sort of the worm has turned, right? Europe is actually doing much more in terms of economic sanctions than the U.S. is. And I think the answer to why has a great deal to do with that energy dynamic that I just discussed.
Okay. And on the subject of sanctions, sanctions by themselves don't seem to have the policy impact we'd like them to have. If they did, Iran would have disappeared. The mullahs of Iran would have disappeared by now, you know, and other sorts of things would have happened. So each country is apparently choosing between the financial hardship imposed by sanctions and the policy goal that it wants to pursue. So the Palestinians choose between, you know, paying terrorist salaries and making schools. Iran chooses between agricultural policy and funding Hezbollah. Russia chooses. Why do we think that sanctions will do it for us? Or are sanctions a stepping stone to something else?
Well, I think both, right? I mean, that's a really interesting conversation to have, because I happen to, since you brought up Iran, I have to confess, I'm not a huge fan of the term maximum pressure as implemented by the last administration, because maximum pressure suggests that you're pretty much doing everything you can. And that wasn't the case. There was a tremendous amount more, even non-militarily, that we could have been doing to squeeze and pressure Iran. But the hallmark of that was we were doing it with only grudging support from the international community, right? We saw the Chinese cheating. We saw sort of the Turks serve as sort of intermediaries for Russian money, I mean, for Iranian money. And so we were leading the maximum pressure effort. What you're seeing now, I think, is qualitatively different. This campaign against Russia isn't even being led by us. It's being this sort of united front that you see on the part of Western countries. And so I think this is probably the best test case you're going to have about the efficacy of sanctions as a tool of coercion, as a tool of behavior modification. Because what you have now is the sort of perfect storm of outrage from the Western community, of an international consensus about the need to isolate Russia. It's the climate that you need in order for sanctions to be really effective, truly effective. Now, are they going to change the thinking in the Kremlin? I'm not sure. But you're already beginning to see it change the thinking on the Russian street, right? You're beginning to see protests on the Russian street. You're beginning to see a very harsh Kremlin reaction to those protests. There was this fascinating thing that happened over the weekend, which I think most people miss, but it's enormously significant. The Council of Europe has all these alphabet soup institutions, right, that really don't do anything except push paper and make European parliamentarians feel good about each other. But one of them is the Council of Europe. The Council of Europe is supposed to be this sort of second layer talking shop, sort of that overlays the European Union. They do other things as well, but that's sort of functionally what they are. The Council of Europe voted over the weekend to kick Russia out, right, to essentially effectively say Russia is not a part of Europe. Right. And that's always been the sort of the post-Cold War debate about where Russia fits. The Russians immediately turned around and reinstated the death penalty within the country. Right. And that was a signal not to us, but to Russian dissidents who might think about coming out, to Russian political opponents might think about coming out into the street, that, you know, the gloves are off. We are now not beholden to European norms. And you're going to see things like you saw sort of during the darkest days of the Soviet Union, where political oppression would get you disappeared, or political opposition would get you disappeared. And so my sense is what you're seeing, the ferment that you're seeing on the Russian street is being catalyzed by all this Western pressure. Whether or not it ends positively or in tragedy, I think it's early days.
So that's a second front, though, for Putin, which leads to my next question. I think Putin expected a sort of cakewalk to Kiev, you know, that he was just going to roll in and everybody was going to lay down and he was going to get to Kiev. And it didn't go that way. He also said on the first day that Russia was hitting only military targets. They had no intention of hitting civilians. They had no intention of hitting civilian targets. Clearly, all of this has gone by the wayside. And then they put their nuclear forces on alert and, you know, that sort of stuff. So I have a sort of broader question for you. Did we build up in our minds the Russian capability to do damage? And do we do the same thing with China? China's not the area that we're going to talk about today. But every time the Chinese claim to have done something militarily fabulous and striking and they can kill us in our bits, we agree that they did, or we assume that they did. And I think we did the same with Russia. Are we going to have to reevaluate? Have we, and maybe this is because we have problems in our own military, and our own military spending, have we built them up to be bigger, better, stronger than they actually are? Clearly Putin thinks they were supposed to be bigger and better.
So I think there's a fair bit of that. And I think there's a fair bit of that. Look, I don't think it makes sense to make anybody, to depict anybody as 10 feet tall, whether it's the Russians or the Chinese. But you have to understand that the Russian military is effectively an untested force. The last major conventional military engagement that the Russians engaged in was 1948. World War II and sort of leading up to 1948, sort of in the sort of the demobilization. You can always point to the Soviet campaign in Afghanistan between 79 and 89, but that was a partisan war. And as you recall, the Soviet Union didn't fare very well in that partisan war. And so what you have ever since has been a Russian military that looks really good on paper, but in terms of maneuvers, in terms of capabilities, it's really an untested force. The other thing that you have, which is I think very significant, is that you have very long logistical tails that the Russians have right now. And that's why the entry today, earlier today, of Belarus into the Ukrainian front is actually very significant. Not so much because the Belarusian military is gonna light the world on fire, but because the Belarusian military is closer and can bring greater supplies to the front and quicker than the Russian military can. But I think the point remains, right? What you're looking at is a Russian military which has trafficked for decades on its glory during the Great Patriotic War, sort of, you know, lionized its military officials. A lot of these guys are sort of holdovers from, if not from World War II, because they would be extraordinarily long in the tooth, but certainly from the 60s, the 70s, the sort of the military buildup, the Cold War military buildup that you had then. But they haven't really thrown their metal into the fire in a really significant sense. There's people who are tracking this much better than I, to be honest, people like Mike Kaufman over at the Center for Naval Analyses, who are really sort of drilling down on the nuts and bolts. But the consensus that you're getting from all these watchers of the Russian military is the Russian military is not all it's cracked up to be. Doesn't mean it can't be, but it's not all it's cracked up to be, both in terms of resources, in terms of materiel, and also in terms of morale. And that's a huge component, because one of the really interesting dynamics that I've been watching has been this tremendous constriction of the aperture available to Russian media, to Russian disinformation, to Russian propaganda, right? You had over the weekend, you had the European Union announce that they were blacklisting Russia Today, which is now known as RT, blacklisting Sputnik. You have television providers in places like Kazakhstan beginning to ban Russian language TV channels, right? This is a huge thing. The reason it's a huge thing is because Russia's, a lot of Russia's appeal and Russia's image of invincibility has been built around that propaganda. It's been built around these narratives that they've been spreading in the West about the decline of democracy, about the disunity of the West, and obscuring objective truth and sort of elevating Russia as a geopolitical player. The available audience for Russia to do that still exists, but it's all within the Russian Federation. It increasingly doesn't exist outside the Russian Federation. And so what you're seeing is, you know, the emperor has no clothes, or at least very few clothes, fewer certainly than Vladimir Putin believed.
So I have to say, I have some problem with banning RT in this country. I would prefer, seriously, that they put a put an icon on it, say Russian government propaganda or something. But it worries me that we can't hear what they're doing unless you speak Russian, read Russian, and go pick it up in Russia. So I'm not thrilled about that. On the other hand, all of this, and you know, I usually save my optimism question for the end, but I'm going to go with it here.
All right.
Germany, the German chancellor has proposed a very large increase in Germany's defense budget. Now it still has to pass the parliament, so we're not there yet. But if you get Germany to start thinking about what the defense of Europe needs to look like in the future, and it's Germany's understanding that you need more, bigger, better, and that deterrence without military behind it is not deterrence at all. I mean, deterrence that says, well, I'm going to laugh at you, or I'm going to stick up my middle finger. It doesn't work. This is the Israeli lesson that if deterrence is going to happen, it's going to happen because people understand it. Okay. Is there a possibility that NATO will take a look at Europe and say, we used to be a military alliance for a reason. We used to have military goals and aspirations and requirements, and go back there? Any chance for a renewed NATO?
I think so. And I think because what I'm sort of seeing sort of in the broad sort of 60,000 foot level is two really interesting trends, right? Really consequential strategic trends, right? The first is what you could call the return of history, right? So if you remember, I'm sure you do, I'm sure the watchers remember as well, the political scientist Francis Fukuyama in the early 1990s wrote an article and then a book called The End of History and the Last Man. And it was all about the ultimate triumph of liberal democracy, right? And his book was debunked like legitimately months after it was published by, you know, the Balkan Wars and the wars in Chechnya, sort of, you know, things like that. But it's a theme that has been remarkably persistent, remarkably stubborn, right? The idea that we're sort of at the terminus of our political evolution. But what we're actually now witnessing is a return of history. There's a reason why people are making analogies to 1914 to 1938, right? Because what you're looking at is a situation that has a lot of historical parallels. So there's parallels of an autocratic leader, sort of out of touch with prevailing geopolitical trends, sort of unfamiliar with the territory that he's trying to conquer, right? And sort of all the misery that flows from that, right? But there's historical parallels here, right? So that, I think, drives us very naturally into a conversation about, you know, NATO was created for a reason. NATO was created for right? And you know, the sort of the diplomats at the time would joke over scotch that NATO was created to, what is it, to keep the French in, the Germans down, and the Russians out, right? Okay. I'm not sure that formula quite obtains, except for that last part, right? The idea is increasingly, it's no longer a debatable construct, except in sort of in the fever swamps of sort of some very peculiar political strains, that Russia is not a constructive international actor, right? Russia's not a victim, the way Putin has portrayed it. Russia is waging a war of aggression, and we need a unified front to stand against it. And that has to be sort of, you know, a stiffening, the result of that has to be a stiffening of the spine for NATO, at least temporarily. And I hope that happens. The second trend, which is sort of, I think, still unbaked, is that this is now the post-Cold War era, right? You could sort of bookmark the post-Cold War era from the collapse of the Soviet Union up until last week, right? Where we knew what we were coming after, but we didn't really know what we were, right? We had all these prevailing trends, international terrorism, jihadism, right? All of these are extremely important, but we didn't have a unifying sort of ethos, thesis. We now do, I think, at least for a short period of time, hopefully for a longer period of time, but at least for a short period of time. And it looks an awful lot like the Cold War era did. Right. And it requires us, Republicans and Democrats, to sort of to start thinking strategically, right, about sort of what the connective tissue is, what the United States wants to say to the world. More importantly, what role the United States wants to occupy in the world. These are conversations that, frankly, we should have been having all along. But, you know, what do they say? Better late than ever?
You can hope so. Yes. Okay, so we're doing the 50,000 foot thing. We're starting to get questions from people. Actually, we're not starting. They've been doing it all along.
okay.
One question is, will Kiev fall, in your opinion? Second question, some Russian soldiers appear to have said, now, everybody is skeptical of every bit of video that comes out in this war, and they should be skeptical. But it does appear that some Russian troops have said that they didn't think they were going to attack Ukraine. They were told they were going on maneuvers and that it wasn't a war. And they discovered afterwards that, in fact, they're expected to kill people. What on the ground should worry us? Could Kiev fall? I mean, they hit Babi Yar this right. morning, the Russians.
No, they did. They did.
They did.
So let me take sort of the back end first and sort of move through. So I think the question of morale is a huge one. Personnel is policy, right? And what you're seeing is, you know, Russian soldiers who are calling back to their mothers, calling back to their loved ones, saying, you know, we were duped. You see Russian military personnel surrendering to Ukrainian villagers. And overall, and this is where the Ukrainians, I think, are really sort of mastering the information space. You see images of Ukrainians as happy warriors, which is something the Russians are not. And these are sort of being beamed back into Moscow to the extent that, you know, the filters let them through. This has an enormous demoralizing effect. The other thing that has a demoralizing effect is that Russia is not existing in an information vacuum, despite the fact that the Kremlin is trying its best to sort of to impose those blinders, right? It's sort of blocking Facebook, blocking Twitter, right? Unless you have a VPN, you can't really sort of get on social media. And yet you see Russians begin to read and recognize sort of very ominous signs, like the fact that the Russian military has mobilized mobile crematoriums to follow Russian troops to the Ukrainian front, right? That's all about messaging, because Vladimir Putin has learned. He learned from his last adventure in Ukraine in 2014 and subsequently in the Middle East that body bags coming home, they don't play well on the nightly news. And so, you know, this is, I think a terrible move, but it really sort of hammers home to everybody, but especially to the Russian military, that what they're embarked on is not the bill of goods that they were sold. And I think that has an enormous effect. Now, that said, that doesn't mean that they're not effective. It doesn't mean that overwhelming force cannot be brought to bear. It doesn't mean that Kiev can't fall. The numbers that you're looking at now, though, are very fluid, right? But let's remember where we started. We started a war in which there was 190,000, 200,000 Russian soldiers that were ostensibly intended to occupy places like Kiev, which has a population of 3 million, like Kharkiv, which has a population of 1.5 million. It's simply not doable. So the numbers make a difference, the numbers that the Russians are losing, but also the numbers that they're getting in terms of reinforcement. Because even if Kiev does fall, where that conversation, and I hope it doesn't, but where that conversation turns, if it does, is a question of, can Russia hold and occupy and sustain, you know, a response to a people's war? And my sense is, right, if you look at the map, the territory of Ukraine is enormous. There's lots of forests, there's lots of woods. This is, and more than anything else, you have a unified population. So my sense is that in historical and numerical terms, the cake is mostly already baked, but a tremendous amount of potential for tragedy still exists in places like Kiev and Kharkiv. I don't know if I answered that question, but that's sort of
where you answered the question and raised another one while you were at it, that should Kiev fall, and we're all hoping that it doesn't fall, but should it fall, can the Russians hold it? Because they will be holding it against a population that hates them. You know, the possibilities for guerrilla warfare and counterinsurgencies and all those things exist. And I think the Russians have to calculate whether if they take it, they can keep it. So it's just a thought.
So no, I think that's right. And so I have to tell you, the all of these analysts that sort of give greater, or at least in the recent past, gave greater credence to Putin's idea that Russians and Ukrainians are one people, gave greater credence to, you know, Ukraine is a, you know, corrupt state. You know, let's be clear, they do have problems with corruptions. They do have problems with oligarchs. That, you know, they're not a perfect state, but it's a corrupt state so much so that it's in terminal decline. Haven't really spent any time there. And I recall the last time I was there was, I don't know, 4 years ago or so. And I recall trying to speak to Ukrainians in Russian, because there's a very healthy Russian-speaking population in Ukraine, particularly in sort of the east of Ukraine in Donbas, but even in places like Kiev. And having not once, not twice, but repeatedly having Ukrainians refuse to speak to me in Russian, to answer me in Ukrainian rather than Russian, right? That bespeaks a pretty profound shift. And so when you're hearing Russians themselves raised the alarm, as Russian military officers did just a couple of weeks ago before the conflict was joined, about the idea that Russia could lose Ukraine forever. This is what they're talking about. They're talking about a national identity that over the last 8 years has congealed in opposition to Russia in a very profound sense. And my sense is that the conduct of the war, sort of what Putin is doing, the fact that Putin is not blinking, the sort of the war crimes that he's committing is forcing that to congeal further. And what you end up with is a unified population, but a deeply, intrinsically, viscerally anti-Russian population as well.
Okay. Good news and bad news in that one. Let's move, because we're coming toward the latter part of the program. So let's move to the question of Israel. I, for one, was shocked that both Zelensky and Putin wanted to talk to Naftali Bennett. What is Israel? Israel is a little country that everybody hates, right? No, actually, it's not a little country that everyone hates. Russia respects what Israel does and can do. Ukraine has very good relations with Russia. So for one moment, Israel was like being bandied about as the mediator. And Aaron David Miller, who I will never again quote on this program, and I don't want to do it now, but he did say, he has spoken up to say that Israel is being disloyal to the American position by not being anti-Russian enough. There is some of that out there, and I promise not to use his name again, but there is some of that. So how does this, what's happening to Israel here? I mean, right. It's not all bad for Israel. I mean, it's bad. Wars are always bad. But in some way, I think Israel has risen to a point in the European, the Russian, the Ukrainian mind to be something that it wasn't before the war.
Right. Well, and by the way, this is something exactly that I encountered just a couple of weeks ago. I was in the region, including in Israel a couple of weeks ago, talking, you know, as the sort of the war clouds were sort of forming over, you know, the Russian-Ukrainian border. And I heard a lot of those mixed messages from Israelis. On the one hand, you have Israelis who say, no, look, you know, we fully understand sort of, you know, the Russians are not nice guys, sort of, you know, our hearts are with the Ukrainians. But on the other hand, I heard from more than one interlocutor, I heard things like, well, Putin, I mean, he's not a nice guy, but he doesn't seem to be an anti-Semite the way Soviet leaders were anti-Semites. And by the way, right, Israel has a population of 2 million people that are Russian or of Russian extraction, right? So this is a constituency. This is a constituency that's big enough that Russian politicians message to during campaign seasons, right? In Russia itself, right? So this is not a bystander. This is a fairly active informational field, at least. And within Israel itself, I think you're seeing this interesting tension, right? Just yesterday, the former prime minister, Bibi Netanyahu, gave a public speech in which he said, you know what, we should keep quiet because we have to keep our eyes on the prize. The prize is Iran, right? Iran is sort of the big mover, the existential threat. This is sort of a sideshow. I don't know that I agree with that. My sense is that, you know, for most Israelis, especially the way the war is being conducted, the way the war is being prosecuted by the Russians, has really crystallized the fact that they have to take sides. But it's interesting, sort of where you started, that the idea that Israel is so sought after, both by Moscow and by Kyiv, it's because of economic dynamism, it's because of technological progress, it's because Israel has things that the Ukrainians want, like missile defense systems, right? And so Israel is a player here. Israel's trying to thread a very delicate needle, because remember that if they tick off the Russians too much, the compact that they have with the Russians in Syria goes away. Already you heard the Russians begin to change their tune on Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights over the weekend, just because there was a anti-Russian protest in front of the Russian embassy in Tel Aviv, right? And so the next day the Russians made a public statement, right? And this was sort of a signal to the Israeli political elite to sort of get their population in line. My sense is this is a dynamic conversation. It's evolving, but at least from what I can see over here, the conversation is evolving squarely in a more activist direction and a more pro-Ukrainian direction than it was just a couple of weeks ago.
Clearly, the Israelis have taken a pro-Ukrainian position in the civilian sense. They have United Hatzalah working in humanitarian aid in Ukraine and things like that. But I suppose, and you know, Israel has made it clear that it stands with the United States. Part of the problem here is it's not clear how far the United States is going. As you pointed out earlier, we are not leading from the front. As President Obama once said, you know, sometimes you want to lead from behind. Sometimes that doesn't work. The Israelis do have to manage their relations between the United States and Russia. But I think there's not really a question about where they come out at the end of the day, which I have to say is just a teeny bit. There's a little nagging piece of me in the back that says, yes, we are here. Yes, it's 2022. But if you don't remember Jewish history in Ukraine, you know, you're not thinking with your full head.
That's
So Jews and Israelis have a lot of things on their plate as they look at Ukraine.
That's right.
And I would also point out that the Israelis have taken Lebanese and Syrian citizens out of Ukraine on their buses. And, you know, that just.
So two things here. One on the sort of the Ukrainian identity thing, which I'm the child of Soviet refuseniks. My family is from Ukraine. My family remembers very well sort of precisely that sort of anti-Jewish sentiment that permeated in Ukraine during the Soviet era. But what I found remarkable just in traveling to Ukraine sort of in recent years has been the degree to which the revision of Ukrainian national identity in a more anti-Russian direction has revised it in a more philo-Semitic direction as well. I mean, Ukraine has a Jewish president. Ukraine, until comparatively recently, had a Jewish foreign minister and a Jewish deputy prime minister, right? Which it at least should give pause to people who uncritically swallow the line that Ukraine is populated by fascists and Nazis, at least Nazis in the context of sort of the way we understand them, right? I think the Russians sort of, you know, are depicting it in a different way, sort of, you know, the Great Patriotic War against the Third Reich and sort of all that. But there's an identity thing that's happening here. And I actually think it's a great one for, you know, Jews like myself, Jews of Soviet extraction, of Ukrainian extraction, who sort of, you know, you have a much more welcoming polity. Now, however we got there, right? We've gotten there because they have defined their identity in an anti-Russian direction. And therefore it's an anti-Soviet direction. And therefore it's a pro-Jewish direction, or at least a neutral Jewish direction, which is however we got here. I'm delighted. The second.
It doesn't hurt that Zelensky is a remarkable public figure. Maybe the best Jewish general since the Maccabees. I don't know. No, there must be some in Israel, but you know, you look at Zelensky and you kind of go back to Jewish history. And I do think that helps. I think that shows people aside of Ukrainian Jews, at least, that behave in a certain way. Okay, keep going.
No. So to your point, so if you're talking about linkages sort of to the Middle East, I think there's three big ones. The first is sort of what we started talking about, which is the, you know, the potential for redefinition of the Israeli-Russian relationship. I don't know where this goes from here. But it's very clear that the traditional status quo of sort of, you know, letting Putin get away with sort of with whatever, because he's sort of checking all the boxes on places like Syria, on Hezbollah, on Iran, increasingly that doesn't obtain, at least in the national consciousness. And I don't know where the Israeli conversation evolves from here, but it's going to be a really interesting thing to watch. The second trend line is Iran, right? We started talking about Iran at the beginning. It bears noting that our Russia policy vis-a-vis Moscow, not Moscow in relation to Ukraine, but vis-a-vis Moscow writ large, is entirely incoherent, right? Because at the same time as we're trying to sanction the Russians, calling them a sort of an unconstructive actor on the world stage, we are relying on Russia to bring home the shorter, weaker deal that the Biden administration is trying to negotiate in Vienna. Right, the Russians are the principal interlocutor for this revived talks of an Iran nuclear deal, and the Russians and the State Department, as recently as yesterday, was saying things like, "Well, you know, these are two separate issues." But let's be clear: for the Russians, they're not two separate issues. And the idea that the Russians can be sanctioned to the point of a collapse of their economy, but will still be a constructive actor and give us what we want on the Iranian front, frankly, is not only naive, it's ahistoric. That is what it is, right? And the third trend, which I think is really interesting and most people aren't tracking, is the food issue, which I think is much larger than most people understand. So Ukraine is not for no reason considered the breadbasket of Europe. Ukraine provides cumulatively something like half of all grain imports into the European Union. But it does the same for a lot of countries in the Middle East. Ukraine provides 50% of wheat imports for Israel. Ukraine provides 43% of wheat imports for Libya. Ukraine provides 55% of wheat imports for Lebanon. And, you know, and Russia, by the way, provides a lot of the rest. But what you're seeing, particularly as this conflict drags on, is, to me, the open question, the really fascinating question and also troubling question is whether or not Ukraine can sustain that role as a supplier of foodstuffs to the Middle East while it's under the sustained siege, while its economy is sort of folding, while its industries are being repurposed for the war effort. Now, not at risk of sounding alarmist, I would only point out that globally, grain is already at the price it was. When it was this price last time was a decade ago, and the result was the Arab Spring. And so there's a very strong connective tissue between food security and social instability, particularly in weak states, in places like Africa and in the Middle East. And so the sort of my big takeaway from all this is that everything increasingly is interconnected. And what happens in Ukraine and how long it takes place in Ukraine is very likely to have a ripple effect far beyond sort of what most people traditionally think.
So as we're coming to the end here, I think there are a couple of takeaways that will provide us with many more webinars, and perhaps you'll come and join us again.
Good.
One of which will be whether and how NATO looks at itself and its responsibilities in Europe, and whether it can actually create the kind of military force necessary for the 21st century. Second may be a revisiting of nationalism. In the United States, in the West, nationalism is considered to be just the worst possible thing. I mean, nationalism, that's where the Nazis come from. But you talked about nationalism in Ukraine in a more positive sense. Nationalism can also bring us to a different place, a positive place politically. And I'm going to use this for a second to do a commercial for Thursday's webinar, which is Josh Hammer, Newsweek opinion editor and great guy and brilliant thinker, who was in Hungary and talks about nationalism in Central Europe and how that's going to play out. And I don't know, if I'm looking for something positive, do I say to myself, maybe the Allies will find a way to military security, and maybe the Allies will find a way to live with who they are. Is that my positive note for the day, Elon? And if not, what's yours?
Oh, well, I'm not sure that I have anything positive to say, but I think that's an interesting conversation. The one positive takeaway is, if we're talking good news stories, I have two, right? And it's, I spent the weekend watching interchangeably Fox, MSNBC, CNN, and Russian televisions like Russia 24. Now, that fourth category aside, which, you know, was just odious, right? What I found, especially at the tail end of this sort of very tumultuous couple of years in terms of political cycles, in terms of media coverage, was a narrowing of the discussion about Ukraine, right? There's outliers, of course, but I actually found it very salutary that you could switch from channel to channel and you have pretty much a centerline discussion, just the facts, military analysis, right? Sometimes you have a feint towards the political left or a feint to the political right, but this sort of old-fashioned reporting the news, reporting, you know, sort of war crisis reporting, the way, you know, it may be nostalgic for the way things used to be. And I don't know that this obtains over the long term, but at least temporarily is a very nice reprieve, right? And the second thing is that Ukraine has really reset the table in terms of the discussion within the United States about sort of the proper place of internationalism, right? And so particularly in the Republican Party, you've had this sort of running gun battle between isolationism and nationalism and sort of what's the proper role of foreign policy. And increasingly, I think this conflict, I mean, it's a terrible thing, but this conflict has had a clarifying effect about the importance of the American role in the world, the importance of American leadership, the importance of international engagement, the value that's connoted by collective action, right? From a concert of democracies, right? All that stuff is good news. All that stuff is stuff that we haven't been talking about in recent years. but it's sorely needed.
I think that's a great place to end this conversation, because it is a positive note, a couple from me and a couple from you. So Elon Berman, let me thank you for joining us once again.
Of course.
You've made us smarter. We're not as smart as we could be or should be, but you have helped to move us down the pike. So thank you. And thank you everyone for tuning in and listening. And you will get your invitation to Thursday's meeting. We're going to reconvene at noon on Thursday. Elon, thank you.
Thank you, Shoshana.